I want to start today by finishing up one little piece that I forgot last time. And that is, we were talking about RTK, receptor tyrosine kinases. And you don't need the handout for this, but on 22B on the bottom, there was a little box we didn't discuss what it means. And the little mysterious box looks like this. And I just wanted to explain very briefly what this is, and because I think it's explained very well in the notes, so I don't think you need the handout if you don't have it with you. However, I brought copies of both handouts from last time because I noticed attendance was a bit sparse and the pile was a bit big. So they're over there if you want to pick them up later. We said that what these receptor tyrosine kinases do is that they're monomers and they dimerize when they bind their ligand. And it's the dimerization that starts the signaling process. And you remember what we said last time is that what normally happens is that the activated enzyme or tyrosine kinase on this subunit phosphorylates the tyrosines on the other subunit and vice versa. And so as a result, the cytoplasmic domain becomes phosphorylated and sticky, and other proteins stick to it and become activated. Now, what happens in an individual who is heterozygous so that half the monomers are normal and half of them are abnormal? Usually in that circumstance, if half the protein works, it works, and the other half lies around and doesn't make any difference. But this is different, because if half the monomers are normal and half of them are the defective, then many of the monomers, dimers, will have one of each. And this dimer will be inactive, because this dimer cannot phosphorylate itself. And as a result, the bottom won't be sticky, and you won't get any signaling or any activation. Now, this phenomenon is a description of what is called a dominant negative mutation, and it is described very clearly in the notes, and I don't want to go into all the details. But the implication is, if you have a mutant protein, and in a heterozygote, you have a mutant phenotype, it often means that the protein you're looking at works as multimers. So as long as one copy is bad, the multimer is bad, the aggregate is bad, and you don't get function. Now, I think that covers just about everything that is in the notes for last time, except about how ADH and aldosterone affect kidney function, and we'll get back to that today. Now, last time we talked about the processes that take place in the kidney. And I want to remind you that what happens is tubular. I want to tell you what those remind you of what those four are. And then we want to look at kidney structure and see where in the kidney does each of these take place and how does it happen. And I see that there's a bit of feedback, so I'm going to turn down the mic a little. Okay, so the first thing is tubular reabsorption. But before that can happen, you have to have filtration. And then we have tubular secretion. And the final one was volume control. So filtration is how liquid gets into the kidney tubule. Tubular reabsorption is about removing things from the tubule. Tubular secretion is about adding things you don't want to the tubule, so they'll go out in the urine. To go back to tubular reabsorption, that's a way of recovering things from the filtrate that you don't want to lose, that you want to retain in the body. And then finally, there's the issue of the volume control. You can lose a lot of urine and a lot of water if the urine is very dilute, or you can excrete very concentrated urine and reserve water. So we want to consider how you do these things. In order to do that, we have to look at the structure of the kidney and what goes on in each part. And that's on handout 23A. So what we have here is three pictures. And the first one is a gross sort of picture of a kidney, which looks sort of like this. This is in the upper left. And this is the gross anatomy of what it looks like. That the kidney has two layers, just like the adrenal does. It has an inner and an outer layer. So the inner layer is known as the medulla, and the outer, so starting here, the rest of it inside is called the medulla. So the medulla would be all this stuff in the middle. And then the stuff on the outer layer is called the cortex, very similar to with the adrenal. The inner is the medulla, the outer is the cortex. And when you look at it visibly, you see these structures that are called renal pyramids. Now, what these are is the bottom of what is called a nephron. A nephron is the functional unit of the kidney. It is a kidney tubule all coiled up. And the kidney has many, many nephrons, and they're arranged in bunches. So there's a group here, another group here, etc. And the renal pyramids represent the bottom of the nephron. You can't see the rest of it in a picture. But we have pretended you could see one. And if you could, a nephron would be here, with its top sticking out into the cortex and its bottom going into the medulla. Now, what we have done in the next picture on the right is to enlarge one nephron to show you how it's coiled up. So here we've drawn it like this. Now, the nephron itself is a hollow tube, and that's one of the reasons we have the picture on the bottom, to remind you that it's really a hollow tube. I drew it as a line on the left to make clear what the setup is, but this line represents a hollow tube with a lumen in the middle, and this is where the filtrate is. And this tube is lined with cells on both sides, and that relates to this picture we had last time. Here are the cells lining the tubule on the two sides. And these are joined, actually, with tight junctions. And the filtrate goes down the middle. And there's a capillary nearby. So this picture, this represents the loop. Now you see that the way the loop really goes, things go in, they go down the backside, and up the front. But in our bottom picture, we've untwisted the loop. This is called the loop of Henle. And we'll look at the loop, the bottom structure a little bit more when we get into the details of how reabsorption and secretion work. But to come back now to this nephron that we drew. This part up here is where filtration occurs. So there would be capillaries in here, and liquid would go from the capillaries into the tubule. So this is these are the glomerular capillaries or the glomerulus. And this structure here, at the end of the starting end of the kidney tubule, is called Bowman's capsule. And it sort of encloses or goes around the glomerulus. Now, if you look at this tube here of the nephron, you notice that it's coiled, and then it loops down into the medulla, and then it's coiled. And this part up here with the coils would be in the cortex. And these are referred to as the proximal and distal convoluted tubule, or just tubule. So you have the proximal, this again is using proximal and distal to mean near and far relative to the beginning. So there's the proximal part of the tubule. And then there's the loop of Henle. And then there's the distal part. Now, this part here is a collecting duct. What happens is that multiple nephrons feed into the same collecting duct. So there would, the nephron is really, in some ways, just the part up to here. And then there would be another nephron connected at each of these branch points. And all those nephrons would feed into the same collecting tubule. So what happens then is the liquid passes in from the glomerulus, through the proximal, through the loop of Henle, through the distal, into the collecting duct. And at this point, everything, all the adjustments of what has to be reabsorbed and what has to be secreted and what has to be done is pretty much done, except for the control of water. So the control, removal of water, if necessary, takes place largely in the collecting duct. Now, what if we go back to those processes that we talked about? Where do they take place? So, maybe the one other thing we should say in the structure department is we didn't say anything about the capillaries. We talked about the capillaries last time, and we said there are actually two capillary beds here. This is one capillary bed. We have very finely branched blood vessels with no smooth muscle. But there's another capillary bed that surrounds the tubule, a second one. So if we do a subway diagram, here comes your arteriole, and it branches into capillaries at the glomerulus, and then it branches back, and then it branches again. But it branches in a way so as to surround the loop of Henle and the tubule. So instead of drawing it the usual way, I'm going to draw it more like this. And then those collect into a venule. So we have two capillary beds, one in the glomerulus and one around the tubule, which for the record is called the vasa recta. Now, you notice here I've got an arteriole and a venule and something in between. So these are both considered arterioles, but one of them is before the glomerulus and one is after. So this is the afferent because it goes into the glomerulus, and this is the efferent because it comes out. And the reason these are both arterioles, they're both surrounded by smooth muscle, which means they can be constricted or expanded. And in fact, expanding the first relative to the second, the afferent, changing the diameter of the afferent is one way of changing the flow and the push through the kidney. Okay. So I think that takes care of the structure. And now let's see where the various processes take place. Now, filtration occurs in the glomerulus, in Bowman's capsule, that we said last time about 20% of the liquid in the blood is pushed into the kidney tubule. And the other 80% continues on. Now, there really is a filter here consisting of the various structures and extracellular material. Now, that means that cells and large proteins don't get into the tubule. So all that's getting into the tubule is the liquid with dissolved small molecules and a few very small proteins. But relatively small things, cells and big things, don't get in. Now, what happens in the proximal? Remember, this is surrounded by capillaries. So that means that material can move out of the tubule into the capillary, or from the capillary back into the tubule. Now, which of these is which? Tubular resorption Reabsorption is when the material is absorbed from the tubule back into the body. And secretion is when material leaves the capillary and is secreted into the tubule. Now notice, as we explained last time, in order to do either of these trips, you have to go across the two membranes of the cells surrounding the capillary, and you have to go across the interstitial fluid till you get to the capillary, and of course you have to get into the capillary, usually in the spaces between the cells. Now, I didn't draw a capillary over here, but there is one. There are capillaries all around here surrounding the tubule. So most resorption and secretion occurs in the proximal tubule. A few things are reabsorbed or secreted elsewhere, but most of it happens in the proximal tubule. And in your notes, the details are here, but we're going to come back to it. So most of the secretion and resorption occurs here. Now, what happens in the loop of Henle? Liquid goes down, and liquid goes back up. And in this case, I've untwisted it to make it sort of clear that the liquid goes down and back up. It turns out that on the way down, you concentrate the material because you lose water. And on the way up, you dilute the material. So you concentrate on this side. And you dilute on this side. Because on the ascending, what you do is you lose salt. Now you might ask, what's going on here? You start out with liquid, with filtrate, that is isoosmotic to the blood. How osmotic something is a measure of the concentration of particles. So something like sodium chloride generates two particles per molecule. Something like glucose generates one particle per molecule. This is defined in your notes. So you start out with the same osmotic concentration, more or less, as the blood. But now you concentrate it until the maximum concentration and the maximum osmolarity is at the bottom. But it looks like that all goes to waste, because then you pump the salt back, and when you get finished, you're actually more dilute than the blood. When you get finished, you're hypoosmotic to the blood. Now, why bother? When you get finished, notice that the volume is much less than when you started with. Even if you had the same osmotic conditions as when you started, you got a lot less to deal with, because you took the water out, a lot of it in the descending, and then you took a lot of the salt out in the ascending. So that you've gotten rid of a lot of the stuff and you have much less to worry about. So that's the advantage one. So you have decreased the volume when you get to the bottom. Now this volume of filtrate is quite dilute when you get to here. Now what's the advantage of that? In the remaining part of the tubule, in the distal tubule and the collecting ducts, you can remove more water, but you can't add any. So if you start out with a very dilute filtrate, you can leave it dilute and lose a lot of water. Or you can take water out and make it more concentrated and lose very little water. But since you can't add water now anymore, it's better to start dilute. And then you take out as much water as necessary and lose the rest. Now, so what happens now in the distal tubule and the collecting duct is largely, there is some secretion and absorption, but mostly volume control. Now, people divide what happens up here in these, in the remainder, into really sort of two parts. Because, as we indicated, it was in the notes last time, we didn't get to it, what goes on in the distal tubule and the collecting ducts is influenced by ADH and aldosterone. Aldosterone largely controls sodium recovery, and ADH water. Aldosterone acts mostly in the distal tubule, and ADH mostly in the collecting duct. It turns out that by the time the filtrate has gotten this far to the distal tubule, most of the sodium is already gone. But the aldosterone controls whether a little bit more sodium will be removed or not. And it's only a small percentage, but every pass you can take out a small percentage and that adds up. And finally, ADH controls how much water is recovered and how much water is left in. So this is the big picture. And now we want to look back a little bit more at the details of how does this work. And in the proximal, we want to consider more about resorption than secretion. Secretion is very important. A lot of drugs and toxins are secreted, in fact, and many in the proximal tubule. That is, they are specifically pushed out or pulled out of the capillary into these cells and put into the tubule. And that usually means, that means there has to be transporters for these compounds on the cell, on the membranes of the cells involved. And usually one at least of these transporters is active. But we're not going to talk so much about secretion as about reabsorption. And one of the reasons for that is that the process of reabsorption is very should be very familiar to you. Because it's very similar to what happens when you consider the cells that line the GI tract. Remember we drew these polarized cells where here was the lumen of the GI tract and here was the body. We have a very similar setup in the cells lining the kidney tubule. Here's the lumen of the kidney tubule. Here is the body. And these are also polarized epithelial cells. They have, as I think we mentioned last time, they have a luminal or apical surface, and they have a basolateral surface. And just as with the cells lining the GI tract, these two surfaces are distinguished by having different transporters in them. And the cells are joined by tight junctions so that the two proteins on the two surfaces do not mix. So if liquid is going to leave the tubule, it's going to have to pass the luminal or apical surface, travel through the cell, and go out the basolateral. This should sound familiar. If materials are going to leave the lumen of the GI tract, they have to pass the apical, go through the cell, and leave by the basolateral. And the setup is very, very similar. Consider glucose. Glucose gets out of the lumen into your body from the filtrate of the kidney in very much the same way it gets out of the GI tract into your body. That is, active transport with sodium, co-transport with sodium across the luminal surface, and then passive transport through a glute transporter out into the interstitial fluid and from there to the blood. So, if you have glucose or amino acids in the filtrate, now would you have that? Those are normally found in the blood. You normally have glucose and amino acids, which are being carried around as nutrients to various parts of the body. And 20% of them end up in the filtrate. Now, the point of reabsorption is to save stuff that you don't want to lose in the urine. So virtually all the glucose and amino acids in a normal person are reabsorbed in the proximal tubule. So there are transporters not only for glucose, co-transporter of glucose and sodium, but there are transporters for co-transport of sodium and amino acids. So amino acids and glucose and many other small molecules are specifically reabsorbed. They use an active co-transport with sodium into the cell, go across the cell, out passively through a transporter, and into the blood. So in a normal person, all that stuff is recovered and none of it is lost in the blood. Now, in diabetes, there is so much glucose in the blood and therefore so much in the filtrate that the transporters are saturated and cannot recover all the glucose. And so some of it is lost in the urine. And the original test for diabetes was to taste the urine, which is also called diabetes mellitus because it's sweet, because there is sugar in it. There is another kind of diabetes called diabetes insipidus. In both of these, there is too much volume. But in that case, it's mostly water, and so the urine is not sweet. These days, we test other ways to tell which it is. Okay. Now, in order for this to work, in order for us to have co-transport with sodium, what has the sodium have to be inside the cell? It has to be low. And so all of these cells have a sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral side, just like the cells lining the GI tract. Almost all cells have a sodium-potassium pump. There is one exception in this picture, but almost all of them do. And so almost all of them have low sodium, which allows them to bring sodium in or to power co-transport with that sodium. If there were just sodium channels here, then because of the sodium-potassium pump, sodium would flow into these cells and out to the other side. But in the cells of the proximal tubule, there are no channels for sodium. There are only transporters, co-transporters for sodium and something else. So every time sodium goes into the cell across and retains in the body, it drives some other substance with it, an amino acid, glucose, etc. Now, before we leave the proximal tubule and get to the loop of Henle, are there questions about this? Yes?
Is there a specific transporter for amino acids in that way?
Is there a specific transporter for amino acids? There are several, for one for each class of amino acids. And the same is true in the GI tract. Okay. So what happens in the loop of Henle? How does this work? Now, we said last time that what's different, what's the same about the tubule, is that the tubule always looks like this. It always has cells on polarized cells on both sides and a capillary not far away. But what's different is what transporters for substances are found on the luminal and basolateral surfaces, and most but not all the variations in the luminal. So if we now consider what's going on here. In the descending, you lose water but not sodium. So that means that the membranes of this cell, both membranes are permeable to water, but one at least is not permeable to sodium. And these cells probably don't have a basolateral sodium-potassium pump. And as a result, they don't pull sodium in and they don't pump sodium out to the body. So sodium is not pulled through these cells. So these cells don't let sodium pass, but they let water pass. Now the cells in the ascending are the opposite. They do not have water channels on both sides of their membrane. One or both does not. So the cells on the ascending are impermeable to water. They don't have water channels. But they do have a sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral side. So that means that as a result, where's the sodium going to go? Well, it isn't enough for them to have a basolateral if they're going to pump sodium out. They have to have a sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral side. So if we look at our reference picture, over here they'd have the sodium-potassium pump. How are they going to pull sodium out? They have to have sodium channels, not co-transporters. But they have sodium channels on the luminal side, so sodium goes all the way through into the capillary and is carried away. Some of it's carried away, not all of it. Because this makes the most... What happens to all that sodium? Even though liquid goes first through the descending and then back up through the ascending, what is happening here is a little easier to understand if we look at the ascending first. So what's happening is, as the liquid moves up, sodium is basically being pumped out of the tubule across the cells into the body. And a little of that is carried away by the capillaries, but most of it remains. And it actually generates a gradient of sodium in the kidney. So there's a gradient here, which is heavier sodium, higher concentration of sodium in the medulla, and lighter as you go out toward the cortex. So the pump generates the sodium gradient. Notice that the capillaries around the tubule don't leave at the bottom, they leave at the top. So that means that the liquid at the top is in equilibration with the low sodium. It doesn't carry very much sodium away. So most of the sodium is not carried away by the capillaries, but sits there making a gradient. Now, if there's a gradient of sodium, now let's go back to the descending. If there's high sodium outside and there are water channels, what will the water do? This is why the water goes out. Because there is high sodium out here, outside in the medulla, as the water goes down, there's always more sodium, higher concentration sodium outside than inside. And since there's more sodium outside, water osmotically is pulled out, trying, so to speak, to equalize the concentration. So the sodium can't move in, instead the water moves out, down its gradient. So if we lose water on the down and we lose sodium on the up, is there any difference? Is either of these, are these both passive? Is either one passive? Which one requires ATP? This one does. Because here we're actively moving sodium against its gradient. It's already high outside and we're pushing it anyway. But here, on the down, on the descending, this is a passive process. We've already set up the sodium gradient. So if we open water channels, water will diffuse down its gradient into the sodium. Now, the reason this works is that if you consider going up, fresh material with more sodium comes along. Some of that sodium is pumped out. Then more fresh material with a lot of sodium comes. Some of that sodium is pumped out. And that's how you get the gradient. And then that gradient pulls out the water. Now, I think maybe we'll leave it at that, but let me ask first if there are questions before we leave the loop of Henle. Yeah. He says this is the sodium diffuse over to the descending side. Remember that these things are all packed in very tightly. That's one of the points of this picture. So if sodium is in the interstitial fluid around here, it's going to equilibrate, and these two are going to have the same outside environment. And that's because the sodium is being pumped out, and that is maintaining this high sodium gradient, high sodium concentration, and higher on the bottom, because When the sodium enters here, at the bottom, it's the most concentrated. So if we pump out so that the outside is a little higher than the inside, we'll have a lot of sodium out here. But now the sodium moves up. The solution moves up, and it has less sodium in it. So we pump out sodium, so there's more outside. But our starting concentration was lower. So the amount outside is going to be a little lower than it was before. So gradually, we establish lower and lower sodium as we go up. Yes?
So the sodium gradient builds up, makes the gradient for the water to leave both in the descending lubricant and in the distal tubulin, or just...
Oh, her question is, what draws the water out of the distal tubule when the time comes? And that's also the same sodium gradient. So what we're saying is the same sodium gradient exists all over here. So if we have water channels here, we can pull sodium out. But ADH controls those channels. Yeah?
Is it only sodium that creates the gradient, or there are other ions?
Are there other ions as well? Well, if sodium leaves, as I understand it, chloride does also. But the primary gradient that's pulling water is sodium.
And does it have any effect on the proximal tube or distal tube?
Does it have much effect on the proximal and the distal? Well, if you think about the setup, the proximal and the distal are up in the cortex. And most of the sodium gradient is down in the medulla. So we're saying that this part, where the reabsorption is taking place, is where the sodium concentration is normal. So let's look at what happens in the distal and now in the collecting ducts in the final part. Now, we've already said that the major player in the water is ADH. So let's see how the ADH works. This is meant to be the kidney tubule, and these are the cells on the side. So this would be the collecting duct, and the liquid's coming in. Now, these cells have water channels on their basolateral side. They all do. These are constitutive. So this is a water channel. But in one of these cases, there are water channels also in the luminal or apical side. So let's say make it this one. But in the other case, the water channels, remember, these water channels are not there all the time. They are put into the apical membrane and taken out in response to ADH. So they can also be in vesicles, the same way that the GLUT4 glucose transporter can be in vesicles, and in response to insulin, it's put into the membrane. The same way in response to ADH, things move around. Now, this is not the nucleus. This is a vesicle with the water channel. Okay. Now, ADH, antidiuretic hormone, which case is with ADH? I want you to think about these questions for a minute, discuss them with the person next to you. Which case you have more water in the urine? And where are the receptors for ADH? So see if you can answer these three. The person, think about it maybe for a minute and then discuss it with the person next to you, and then we'll see what people think. So we'll call them A. Take a vote. How many people think that B is with ADH? Okay, we have a few. How many people think A? Okay, why is it B?
Antidiuretic hormones, or you want to hold on to water?
Antidiuretic, so it ought to be anti-something. Agreed? But where will the water go in this case? It will go out. So this, in fact, is the diuretic case. Now, this is not an uncommon mistake, and that's why I asked you. ADH is an anti-fusion of vesicles. ADH is anti-making a large volume of urine. So, in fact, which case do you get more volume? In this case, the water goes mostly out. In this case, though, in A, the water is going to go through the channels into the interstitial fluid, into the capillary, and be retained. So A is the one with the ADH. So with antidiuretic hormone, which is pro-recover water hormone, the water then remains. Now, where are the receptors for ADH? There are two sort of obvious possibilities. First of all, okay, ADH is a peptide. So where is the receptor, internal or in the surface? Got to be on the surface. So it's either on the luminal surface, apical, or it's on the basolateral. So it's the receptors, are they luminal, apical, or basolateral? So how many people think they're luminal, apical? Basolateral. Can't tell. Well, the opinion seems to be unanimous that they have to be basolateral. Now, why do they have to be basolateral? Where does the hormone come from? It comes through the blood supply. Remember hormone endocrine? So where is the blood supply in this picture? The blood supply is out here. So the blood supply is coming through that capillary, and the hormone then must be leaving the capillary. And the receptors for the hormone must be on the basolateral side. But where's the action? Notice it's on the other side. The insertion of water channels is on the luminal apical side, but the reception of the signal must be on the basolateral side. And that's because this is a signaling mechanism. When ADH binds to its receptor, that in fact triggers a second messenger, which eventually triggers the insertion of the water channels. Okay. So this is the ADH part. What about the aldosterone part? What does aldosterone do? Aldosterone is a steroid. So where is its receptor? It's inside the cells. And aldosterone allows the resorption of a little bit of the remaining sodium here. Where did most of the sodium go? Well, you actually lose a lot of it here. Remember all that co-transport with sodium? You actually lose over half the sodium here as a co-transporter pushing other stuff. Then you pump sodium out on the way up. Remember the ascending loop of Henle, you pump sodium. So there isn't much sodium left. But that little bit can be let go, or that little bit can be saved. If either you need, one way to reason to save it is because you're low on sodium. Now, aldosterone affects sodium recovery. It also affects potassium secretion. Every time sodium goes one way, the potassium goes the other. We're not going to talk about the potassium at all, but in fact, its job in regulating potassium may be quite important. But if aldosterone causes a little bit of sodium retention, the sodium that's kept will lead to a larger volume of water being retained. Because every time you have more sodium out here, you pull out more water. So as a result of keeping that little bit of extra sodium every time, it adds up, and you can actually cause high blood pressure by keeping that little bit of sodium. And what a lot of anti-high blood pressure medications do is they try and prevent you from keeping that little less, pulling out that little best bit of sodium. Now, we'll come in a minute to how you regulate the production of aldosterone, but first let's just make clear about what it does. Aldosterone allows you to reabsorb a little bit of sodium. So to reabsorb sodium, what do you need? You need a basolateral sodium-potassium pump, and you need channels on this on the luminal side to pull the sodium in. What aldosterone does is to promote the synthesis of all the proteins involved in the pumping of sodium. Now, which is going to work faster, aldosterone or ADH? Why ADH? ADH activates and moves around proteins that are already there. But aldosterone is a steroid and causes the synthesis of new proteins. So that can be a bigger effect, but it takes longer to happen. Now, the one thing, though, is ADH works quite quickly to insert water channels. That's a very fast response. But to affect the volume of urine takes a while because it has to pile up. You have to wait for the filtrate to come through multiple times in order to affect the volume. Now, ADH does have another function to which we'll return. Remember, it has two names. Its other name is vasopressin, and that's because it's very effective at triggering the constriction of peripheral blood vessels. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But the one other thing now that we want to discuss is what regulates the production of aldosterone and what regulates the production of ADH. So let's do ADH first. We know already where ADH comes from. Where's that? Worst came to worst, you could look it up. You have a handout, but you don't want to bother now. ADH comes from the posterior pituitary. So what happens is that what causes it to be released, it's released, the hypothalamus actually has those long neurons that extend into the posterior pituitary and release ADH from their ends. But what causes the hypothalamus to make ADH? There are actually two sensors that regulate the production of ADH. One responds to changes in osmolarity, and one responds to changes in the arterial blood pressure. Now, the main regulator is this one, because you can think about ADH being primarily in control of osmolarity and not in control of blood pressure. However, the effects of ADH do affect blood pressure, and so it has to be taken into account. Changes in the blood pressure only affect ADH when they're extreme. Now, what would you want ADH to fix? Very high blood pressure or very low blood pressure? ADH would make you do what? Keep water, lose water? ADH would make you keep water. That would expand the volume of your blood. That would increase your blood pressure. So if you have a drastic drop in blood pressure due to, say, an injury, that will trigger the production of ADH. Now, what about osmolarity or concentration of stuff? Which way will trigger ADH? Too much stuff or too little? If your blood is too concentrated, do you want to keep water? Yeah. If your blood is too dilute, do you want to lose water? Yeah. So which case do you want ADH? ADH is when you keep water, right? So you want high salt in your blood and high osmolarity. So either high osmolarity or a drastic loss in blood pressure will cause your hypothalamus to release ADH. And at the same time, it will trigger thirst. Now you see these two? ADH makes you do what with water? Keep what you got. Thirst makes you take in more water, both of which aim for the same effect. So this is what controls ADH production. What controls aldosterone production? We've already said that aldosterone is made by the adrenal cortex, the outer layer of the adrenal. And it also makes cortisol. These are the two major hormones. But it makes these two actually in different cells in response to different stimuli. We already talked about atropic hormones like ACTH or corticotropin. That causes the release of cortisol. This is part of the standard hypothalamus anterior pituitary gland axis. So the hypothalamus kicks in the anterior pituitary makes ACTH, and the cortex makes cortisol, and you respond to stress. But that's not when you need aldosterone. You need aldosterone when you need to conserve salt. And what triggers that is actually another hormone called angiotensin. Now, to be more correct, the active form is angiotensin II. Now, in order to explain the aldosterone business, we have to come back and consider the kidney as a whole. What tells the kidney what to do, not counting the ADH? In order for the kidney to operate properly, it has to have enough flow of liquid through it. And that's measured by what is called the GFR, or the glomerular filtration rate. So this is the glomerular filtration rate. So the kidney has a sensor for determining how much liquid is coming through and how much is being filtered. And there is a local adjustment of this. Remember we said that you can dilate or constrict the afferent arteriole? By doing that, the organism adjusts the GFR slightly. You either increase the push in by dilating, or you decrease it by closing off the afferent. So this is locally adjusted. If the GFR gets a little too high or a little too low, this changes the diameter of the afferent arteriole and adjusts the GFR. And under normal fluctuations in blood pressure, this is enough to keep you in good shape. But if your blood pressure gets too low, then your body takes additional corrective action to increase the blood flow, thereby the filtration, thereby the functioning of the kidney. And the way it does that is, again, it's triggered by the kidney. There are other factors, but here, this is the kidney taking care of itself. So the kidney releases a hormone called renin. Actually, it's an enzyme, I think, not a hormone. Renin as in renal, not renin. I thought this was called renin for years until I went to a high blood pressure expert who laughed at me and said, renin is what cows make for cheese. Renin is what your kidney makes, as in renal. So renin then triggers essentially the production of angiotensin. Now, the process of doing this is complex, and we're not going to go through all the steps of it. The point is that in your blood, you have a precursor to angiotensin. Angiotensin 2. And that's floating around all the time, but it's inactive. The precursor is inactive. And it takes several steps to activate it. And the rate-limiting step is catalyzed by renin. There are other things involved here, too. But we'll just worry about the renin. So if the glomerular filter rate, if the passage of liquid through the kidney gets low enough, the kidney secretes renin. Renin activates angiotensin. And angiotensin causes the adrenal cortex to make aldosterone. And the aldosterone causes you to retain more salt. And the more salt you retain, the more water you retain, and you recover your blood pressure. Now, there's one other piece you have to remember. What's the other effect of ADH besides the water business? What's its other name? Vasopressin. It causes constriction of blood vessels. So does angiotensin too. So both of these cause your arterioles in your peripheral circulation to be reduced in size. Now this may not be their primary function in taking care of things, because you can think of ADH as being in charge primarily of osmolarity, and renin is primarily in charge of fixing your kidney. But both of them reduce the capacitance of your blood vessels. Both of them cut off the circulation somewhat to your arterioles and your peripheral parts of your body, thereby reducing the volume through which the blood has to move, thereby raising your blood pressure. It looks like you have a lot of corrective measures if your blood pressure gets too low. But if your blood pressure gets too high, you're not as good at correcting it. And that may be why high blood pressure is a scourge you've heard of, and low blood pressure isn't such a big deal. It does cause problems, but you don't hear about it as much. Now, I want to talk very briefly about the overall control of blood pressure, and that is on the handout B for today. Now, do not faint. You don't have to memorize this. This is largely for reference, because it puts together a lot of interesting things that we've talked about. But you are not expected to memorize this, but you are expected to understand how the parts fit in. If you were given a question about this on an exam, you would be given the handout. Now, this mess here actually has three parts. It has an inner cycle that involves the heart and the stretch receptors in the arteries. The stretch receptor, so the inner circle part of it, is the main blood pressure regulation. That you have stretch receptors in the arteries, and remember we said low blood pressure is the one you can fix, mostly. The signal from here goes to, it says medulla. Now this is not the medulla of your kidney, but the medulla of your brain. It's part of your brain stem. And it is the IC, or the integrative center for blood pressure. And it sends out messages for your heart to work faster or slower to correct. And you know by now that you have both input, both from the sympathetic and the parasympathetic to your heart. If your blood pressure is too low, the sympathetic makes your heart go better. If it's too high, it's the parasympathetic that calms it down. And this has one additional effect, which is mostly due to the sympathetic, which is affecting, again, the smooth muscle in your peripheral arteries, which can be constricted, thereby increasing the blood pressure by decreasing the volume of your blood vessels. So this is the smooth. So the two big effectors here are the smooth muscle in your peripheral blood vessels and your heart. And they affect, as shown here on the bottom, the heart rate and the strength of contractions, so they can change the heart function, and the capacity of the blood vessels, how much volume the blood has to go through. So if you cut down on the capacitance and you increase the push and the volume and strength of the heart rate, you will increase your blood pressure. And that will fix things. So this is the basic circuit for controlling your blood pressure. However, there are two other add-ons here in this picture. Now, one of them is that there is other feedback into this integrative center, which affects how the circuit works. And one of these, some of this is from your higher brain, which is written up here. That's probably behavioral. And in addition, there's another receptor over here, which says chemoreceptor. Another signal that you better do something about your heart rate, etc., is if the oxygen in the blood is too low. That means things aren't moving around fast enough in order to supply your tissues. So that also feeds in. Now, this is the big main picture for blood pressure. But we've just said that ADH and angiotensin and aldosterone all affect your blood pressure. So you have them as add-ons, if you will, to the system. Now, you can say that they're not primarily in charge of controlling blood pressure, but in their attempts, so to speak, to get the kidney right and the content of your blood right, they can affect blood pressure. And they can be called on in times of extreme blood loss to help fix things. So how do they fit in? We've drawn the hypothalamus over here. And you remember, it gets information from the stretch receptors in your arteries only if they're really out of whack. And it has an osmoreceptor, which is its primary sensor. And in response to input, what it does is by making ADH, it changes your water uptake, which is down here, and it also triggers thirst. I wrote this the wrong way. Thirst is water uptake, and ADH is water retention. So your hypothalamus through ADH can add on one layer to this system. And the only other layer, there are two others here that we've drawn, and that is that the adrenal medulla, we know, produces epinephrine, and that mimics some of the effects of the sympathetic here. But the other thing that's in here is the kidney. The kidney can be stimulated by the sympathetic system, but we're primarily concerned with what it does all by itself. We've already said that if the kidney is not doing too well, it will, in fact, adjust the GFR and maybe secrete renin. And those, and especially through renin, it can activate angiotensin. Now, how does the angiotensin do anything? Angiotensin has multiple effects, but we've talked about two particular ones. We said it causes you to make aldosterone. So how does that affect anything? More aldosterone means you keep more salt. You keep more salt means you keep more water. So that feeds into the retention part. Is there anything else we should put on here? Do any of the things we have here affect something we didn't indicate? The arterioles, remember, and both angiotensin and ADH are vasoconstrictors. These two over here. So we don't want to clutter the picture up too much. But they both affect this part, this effector. They both cause the smooth muscle around the arterioles to constrict, reducing the capacitance of the blood vessels. So I brought this up to show how all the things we have talked about fit together with a few others to control blood pressure. Now, if there are urgent questions about this, we can take them, and if not, are there any? Not urgent. Okay. So what I want to do now for the few remaining minutes is I want to introduce the human immune system, the adaptive immune system, and then we will talk about that largely next time. Now, there is an optional lecture next Tuesday, and I really mean it's optional in that you won't get any problems assigned, and none of that will be on the final exam. But we will be talking then about cancer and control of growth, and if you're planning to take any advanced classes, I strongly recommend coming. But if you don't, I won't be insulted. So let's talk a little bit about the adaptive immune system. Now, you have a so-called innate immune system, and it responds more or less the same way to a whole bunch of different insults. And it's very important. Without it, you'd probably be dead. You probably would have died of some infectious disease. But we're going to ignore it for now and talk about the so-called adaptive immune system. And it has two parts. The one that's involved in the production of antibodies, which is called the humoral immune system, and a part that's involved in the killing of infected cells or rogue cells. And that's called the cell-mediated. Now, for today, we're going to ignore the second half because we only have a few minutes, and we're going to talk about the first half. How does this work? Because it turns out that the cell-mediated has many of the same features, and we'll come back to it. Now, we already know what antibodies are. We've talked about them many times as analytical tools. That antibodies are proteins, and each antibody has at least two so-called grabber ends, two ends that are specific for antigen. By antigen, we mean a foreign substance, often but not always a protein. Now, if I draw my antigen looking like that, you don't actually have one antibody for that antigen. You have one antibody for each piece of that antigen. So you have one antibody with grabbers like that, and one antibody with grabbers like that, and one antibody with grabbers like that, and so on. And each piece of antigen that sticks to an antibody like this, this is called an epitope or an antigenic determinant. And if you, some of this is written on handout C. You can ignore the top for now and just look, that term is on the bottom. Epitope or antigenic, I think that's the term they use, antigenic determinant. Now, the thing that is so surprising, or one of the things that is so surprising about the adaptive immune system, is how specific antibodies are. If you're following in the notes, we're talking about the part where it talks about the features of the immune system. That the antibodies, each antibody is quite specific for a particular epitope or a very small number of similar ones. And there's a match between antibody and epitope or piece of antigen that's like the match between an enzyme and a substrate or a ligand and a receptor, that they really match up. Well, what's so surprising is the huge number of antibodies you can make. You can make an antibody to just about anything, even if it was discovered yesterday. And the question is, how can you make such a large variety of them? And this is the adaptive immune system, so you only make the right one at the right time. You don't make them all the time. If a certain bacterium comes along, you'll make antibody to that. If a certain virus comes along, you'll make antibody to that. Not only will you make antibody to it, but the second time you're exposed to it, you'll make more and better antibody. Faster, more, and usually better. So the so-called secondary response is stronger and faster than the first. And that's called memory. And that's the basis of all vaccines. You're exposed once to a piece of the virus or the bacterium, and then when the real one comes along later, you have antibody and you wallop it. In addition to memory, the adaptive immune system features what is called tolerance. If I inject my protein into you, you'll make antibody. If you inject your protein into me, I'll make antibody. But if I take protein out of me and inject it into me, I won't make any antibody. Somehow I know the difference between my own proteins and your proteins. I know the distinction between self and non-self, and I don't make antibody to non-self. And that's called tolerance. And autoimmune diseases occur when this breaks down, and you start making antibodies to your own proteins, unfortunately, and destroying pieces of yourself. Now, how do you explain all of this? And that's what that handout on the bottom of C is for. Mm-hmm. And let's look at it very briefly, and then next time we will discuss actually how it works. This system is called clonal selection, and it is deliberately and intentionally very similar to natural selection, and shares many features with it. The idea is, how do you make everything possible? How do you account for every eventuality? How do you plan ahead? Biological systems cannot plan ahead. People with brains can, but plants can't. Most organisms can't. How do you plan ahead? You don't, except in the sense that you make everything possible and what works, works. That is the bottom rock of this system. The idea is that you have precursors to antibody-producing cells or B cells, and each of them specializes and makes a different transcript and a different protein. So one of them will have grabbers like that, and one will have grabbers like that, one will have grabbers like that, and so on. Each cell type makes a unique antibody, but the antibody stays on the surface. And you have only a little bit of each of them. What happens if the antigen, the appropriate antigenic determinant or epitope, comes along? Well, which of these is it going to stick to? The way I drew it, it's going to stick to this one. So this cell is going to be stimulated, and all the rest are going to be ignored. And the cool thing is, this cell is already making the right antibody to match the antigen that I added. So one of two things will happen. Either you'll get clonal expansion, or you'll get clonal destruction or suppression. If this happens under the right conditions in your body, and this is a self-antigen, this cell will be destroyed. And you will never be able to make that antibody, and you won't react to yourself. But if you meet this antigen under other circumstances, then this cell will multiply and divide. And it will make two classes of cells. It will differentiate further into effector cells, which are called here plasma cells, and memory cells. The plasma or the effector cells secrete the antibody. How can you go from making membrane-bound antibody to secreted antibody? The old alternative of processing of message, remember that? By reprocessing the same message, you make an antibody with the same grabbers, but a different back end. And so now instead of sticking in the membrane, it's secreted. And that's what these cells do. They make secreted antibody of the appropriate kind in large amount, but they're short-lived and they die off. The memory cells continue to make surface antibody, but they become a little more specialized, and they wait around, and they're long-lived. And so if the same antigen comes along again, they will, in fact, be primed and ready to go, and you will make antibody the second time much faster using the memory cells. And since there are more of them than there were before, you'll make more of it. And this is the way the vaccines work. So this thing is called clonal selection, this whole scheme. And the questions that we have to come back to next time or how can each cell make its own antibody that's different from all the others, and how does this system work? Now, we have the exams from all the classes. We'll give out the morning class first. I apologize for the change in office hours, but I have to go get my crown re-glued back on my tooth. So I'll have office hours after I finish giving the exams back, and then later tonight, 4 to 5. And after the evening class, all of the exams will be put in the boxes on the 7th floor of Fairchild.
Start with a C, the morning C. Start with C1 if you have it. Okay.
So we're going to start with section, the morning section. Bart has A through G. And Ben has H through L. And Ari has S through, let him take the next part, which is M through R. And Naya has S through Z, and she's going to go back in the corner over there. Go all the way back in that corner, okay? So Bart has the beginning, the end of the alphabet is going to be back there in the corner. And after we do this, if there's anyone here from the F class who wants their exam, we'll do that. Ben, you can move over a little if you want, so you don't bump into them.